you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner and Schiff.
May I please report?
May it please the court. Your honors, I'm David Wilson. I represent Shell Oil Company, the petitioner. In my time before the court, I will address how the Court of Appeals erred in reversing the trial court's grant of summary judgment. And this is true for two reasons. First, the lease agreement and the dealer agreement, which controlled the relationship between Shell Oil Company and the plaintiff's employer, does not give Shell a retention of control over areas of safety and security, such as would have been required by this court in Exxon versus Tidwell. Secondly, applying the facts of this case to other cases, in particular a case from a sister court of appeals, the Fort Worth court in Smith versus Foodmaker, the facts that the trial court had before it justified summary judgment. In effect, the opinion of the Texarkana court below conflicts with the opinion of the Fort Worth court of appeals in Smith versus Foodmaker.
Do you think we can look at the testimony of Mr. Herring? Can we look at Mr. Herring's testimony and understanding what the full nature of the agreement between Shell and the franchisee was, or do you say we're limited just to the words of the agreement?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, with respect to the rights of the parties, that is controlled by the agreement. What Mr. Herring testified to as the corporate representative of Shell was his understanding of the meaning of that agreement. We've not taken the position in our brief that the court is somehow precluded from looking at his testimony. His testimony, in essence, if one looks at it, simply says the agreements and the relationship between the parties are controlled by the dealer agreement and the lease agreement.
But anything he says, you believe, can be used in considering whether or not a fact issue has been raised.
Yes, Your Honor. In particular, one thing that Mr. Herring testified to at the Court of Appeals below, or one thing that Mr. Herring testified to that the Texarkana Court relied upon, needs to be analyzed because the Court of Appeals simply got it wrong. That is the issue of whether Shell had the right or the authority to require Lasani, the dealer in this case, to hire security guards. If one looks at Mr. Herring's deposition testimony contained in the record at pages 170 and 171 of his deposition, he denied that he would have that he would do that or had the authority to do that. He denied having knowledge that Shell had the ability to do that. So there is nothing added to this issue of security guards by Mr. Herring's testimony. He disclaimed the ability to do that if one looks at what he testified to. Additionally, the two agreements are silent on the issue of hiring security guards. There's nothing in the dealer agreement or the lease agreement that makes Shell somehow an arbiter of whether security guards can be hired or not.
Well, what if the franchisor had said, we want to install additional lighting. Do you approve of that? And Shell had said, no, we don't approve of that. Would that be an actual exercise of control that could cause a liability hook here?
No, Your Honor. That's what Smith versus Foodmaker addressed, that very same requirement in a franchisor-franchisee agreement and a lessor-lessee agreement. Jack in the Box had the requirement that before the franchisee could make improvements to the premises, any improvements physically at all, Foodmaker had to give written permission. And the Court of Appeals in that case said that's not the kind of retention of control that would give rise to liability over safety and security issues.
No, but my question is, what if they had actually asked? What if they had said, we have this lighting system we want to put in, we're worried about our safety, and they have to run it by you for approval. And let's say they had done that and Shell had rejected it and said, no, we don't approve it. That would be an exercise of control that would cause liability, wouldn't it? That's an exercise of actual control.
That would be an exercise of actual control if that took place. And it's important to keep in mind that the agreement always says, in every aspect of these provisions, that the consent of Shell will not be unreasonably withheld. So that if a reasonable request is made, the agreement provides that Shell cannot refuse it, because the agreement provides that Shell cannot unreasonably withhold consent to make these kinds of improvements.
I guess what I'm getting after is, if the agreement sets up the situation where there has to be approval, and Shell doesn't approve it, there is the exercise of control, then doesn't the contractual retention of that control get you to the same place?
No, it does not. And that's what Smith versus Foodmaker said, that when you have these franchise or franchisee agreements, giving the franchisee the day-to-day control over the operations, simply retaining control over giving permission for improvements is not the retention of that right of control. And we have our agreement, which we don't know if the Smith versus Foodmaker agreement has it, with this caveat that Shell, the franchisor, cannot unreasonably withhold its consent to make those improvements.
What's the evidence then on the Court of Appeals said that Syed had a remodeling proposal that included proper lighting that was rejected by Shell. So what's is there a fact issue on whether the consent was unreasonably withheld or not that would preclude summary judgment? What are the facts on that?
Absolutely, Art. I anticipate Respondent's Counsel is going to show you a copy of the letter and his exhibits. And if you look at that, the letter is dated in December of 1996. It was a letter, if you read it, that was made as part of the application process to become a dealer or lessee. This request was made, and the consideration of it was made before these parties entered into any kind of business relationship at all. There's no evidence in the summary judgment record that I recall to the effect that Mr. Syed renewed this request once he signed the agreements. If you look at the two agreements that govern the relationship of the parties, they are dated June 1st, 1997, prior to or subsequent to this request. So there's no evidence in the summary judgment record that once this relationship took place, that Shell exercised this control over renovations and alterations to the premises. That letter predates the relationship of the parties and does not raise a fact issue over Shell's exercise of control.
What gives me some concern? I understand you say Harrington said he could not, but really, under that agreement, if Shell wanted to exercise the type of control that we're arguing about here, under that agreement, they could have done so, could they not?
Not at all.
Could Shell have said, look, for all of our franchisors out here, we just think that we want our customers to know if they go to a Shell station, they're safe. We want customers to know if they go to a Shell station, it's a friendly atmosphere. And so we think every Shell station ought to have an attendant on duty for safety purposes. And if it's late at night, they ought to have to. This isn't broad enough to, they could have done that.
It is not, Your Honor. All the agreement provides is that the dealer will provide an adequate and competent staff. The dealer has the discretion and the requirement under the lease to provide that staff. It doesn't say that Shell has the ability to require some third-party vendor like a security guard to be retained by the independent dealer. When we look at where the agreement addresses the specific issues of safety, the one area where keeping the premises safe is mentioned in both agreements, particularly 6.1 of the lease agreement and paragraph 11.1E of the dealer agreement, both provide that it is the dealer who has the responsibility to keep the premises safe, orderly, and maintained. Both agreements allocate contractually that authority to the dealer, not to Shell. And simply requiring the dealer as part of that to have an adequate and competent staff is not the kind of retention of control over the specific issues of safety and security that this court talked about in Exxon versus Tidwell. What the Court of Appeals did was take any aspect that Shell retain control over and apply the standard of, well, does it conceivably affect safety and security? In fact, the Court of Appeals used the language a couple of places in its opinion. Did this conceivably contribute to plaintiff's injury? And that's not the standard that this court set forth in Exxon versus Tidwell. The standard is, do the agreements allocate responsibility for safety and security to the dealer, or do they retain it to the franchisor, lessor? The position that Shell is in the position of. By creating this conceptual construct of does this retention of control conceivably impact the injury, in effect, the Court of Appeals opinion below waters down or makes less useful the Supreme Court's opinion in Exxon versus Tidwell. Exxon versus Tidwell was written by this court for the specific purpose of separating the analysis in oil and gas wholesale retail relationships from the old standard of general rights of control. What the Court of Appeals did in this case was analyze general rights of control and extrapolate from that, well, how they might hypothetically have affected security. The Smith versus Foodmaker Court went more straight down the line in that they looked at what was retained and whether that specifically addresses the area of safety and security. That's what the Court of Appeals below should have done, and that is look at whether safety was and security were allocated to Shell or to the dealer. The agreements here, if you one looks at them in their entirety, allocate the responsibility to the dealer. Paragraph 5.2 of the lease agreement says that Mr. Lasani has the sole responsibility for management. Paragraphs 6.1 and 5.4 require Mr. Lasani, Mr. Syed, to maintain the premises, including lighting. He's required to keep the premises in an orderly fashion. He's required to keep the premises safe. Section 5.2 of the lease agreement requires Mr. Lasani to keep the premises illuminated. Lighting is his responsibility. That's one of the things that the respondent asserted in this case. That is that the lighting was deficient. Well, the responsibility for lighting is allocated to Lasani, Mr. Syed, the dealer. In the dealer agreement, 11.1A of that agreement also requires Mr. Lasani, Inc., owned by Mr. Syed, to manage the premises. 11.1C of the dealer agreement requires Mr. Syed, Lasani, Inc., to train the employees. That's another issue that the respondents below pointed to with the Court of Appeals to try to establish control on the part of Shell. That is the training of the employees. Training of the employees is a responsibility contractually allocated to Lasani, the dealer in this case. All Shell did was provide training materials and had the simple requirement that Mr. Lasani use those training materials. That's exactly what the court had before it in Smith versus Foodmaker. And the Fort Worth court said that is not enough. It's important to distinguish here between a concern for security, which Shell expressed by having security matters contained within his training materials, and control over security. This court said in Exxon versus Tidwell, what there has to be in the agreements governing the parties is control over safety and security. And the agreements between the parties specifically allocate the responsibility for keeping the premises safe to the dealer, Lasani, Inc., Mr. Syed. Standards and requirements that Shell has put into the training manual and to the standards for operation exist to protect Shell's brand. And the whole history, and one of the reasons Exxon versus Tidwell exists in this oil and gas wholesale retail context is the history of lawsuits against lessor wholesalers like Shell is that plaintiffs have attempted to use the control retained to protect the brand as some evidence that control has been retained to make the oil company liable for injuries to the dealer's invitees. Exxon versus Tidwell was a time where this court said, we're going to have a different standard. We're going to look at the specific right of control and whether it affected safety and security. And merely protecting one's brand is not a retention of control to affect safety and security.
The Shell brand, I mean, to the extent that the Shell brand is tarnished and you're not going to go to one of their stores because you know there's a high likelihood you may get shot by somebody, isn't that part of the brand? I mean, and the reason that there's these provisions that, you know, Shell can go on and remodel the store or they and they want it run in a clean and a safe manner. I mean, I don't know that you can separate the brand from at least one component being safety on the premises.
And that's a good point, Justice Smith, and that's why the courts have consistently held that merely protecting the brand is not the retention of control over safety and security. There's a case that has been cited by the respondent in their brief, CU versus Chevron, in which Chevron had certain brand standards. They were not the owner of the premises. But the plaintiff in that case in New Mexico attempted to bring Chevron into the mix by saying that their exercise of control, protecting the brand and imposing their brand standards, made them responsible for security on the premises. And the New Mexico Supreme Court said no. We have to focus, as this court said, on do they control safety and security, or that they make it, do they exercise an actual right of control, or do they retain a contractual right of control?
Was there evidence that Shell was aware of a problem with the criminal element in the area in this case?
Not just with respect to this store. Shell does maintain statistics on crime at their branded stores throughout the state, but there's no evidence that was adduced about crime at this specific area. And again, I see that my time's expired. The point I think that's most important to answer your question, Justice Jefferson, is concern for security does not equal control.
Any other questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from our staff.
May it please the court, Mr. Stewart, sorry, we'll present argument with the staff.
May it please the court. Again, my name is Stuart Starry. I'm being assisted by my associate, Mark Montenegro, who will be handling some exhibits as I go through and explain some things. My clients are here. Mr. Muhammad Khan is here along with his wife, Jamila, and his daughter, Jennifer, are also here, and that's my wife sitting next to them. Muhammad Khan came to this country in 1984, almost 20 years ago, as part of a new wave of American immigrants that service a vital role in the American economy. Like in the 1800s and early 1900s, his predecessors, Irish American, Italian American, English American, and German American immigrants came to this country to fill certain roles in the economy, that being in the Industrial Revolution and the labor. Now we have a service-based economy, and again, a new wave of immigrants has come into the service-based economy to allow businesses to effectively compete with one another to keep the prices of our goods and services low. These are the people that work in the convenience stores. They work in the gas stations. They work in the pizza parlors. They work at jobs that might not be agreeable to someone with a higher education, someone who was born in the United States and has higher expectations of their own employability, so to speak. These people serve a vital role in our economy. This case is about protecting those people. The Exxon versus Tidwell case is a case that is designed to balance the ever-present need for a company to be competitive and to allow it to compete with the protection of those individuals. Under the Exxon standard, a company can make some choices with respect to how it manages a convenience store or a gas station in terms of what it decides to control and not to control. And there's an old adage that kind of makes sense here when you think about it, and I was thinking about it this morning. Some time ago, I had an appellate brief to write, and my boss came down and didn't like some of what I was doing and told me, from now on, this other attorney makes the final call on whatever goes in that brief, Stuart. And I was frustrated by that, but in the end, the boss still wasn't satisfied with the brief and blamed me, even though I didn't have control over the final product. That was a frustrating situation, and everybody who's ever been in an employer-employee situation understands that without responsibility and authority, without authority, it's very difficult to be handed responsibility and be held accountable. But under the Exxon standard, accountability is not based on some amorphous overall test. It is based on what the right to control specifically dealt with, so that if an oil company decides to control something, they can be held accountable for that, for the negligent exercise of that control. That is standard boilerplate law in the state of Texas, going from the Redinger case through the progeny.
You're not relying on actual exercise of control there. You're relying on retention of control.
I'm relying on both, Your Honor. One of the issues in this case is that the presence of a security guard might have been requested or ordered by Mr. Herring. And his testimony, if I direct the court to exhibit number 7, if you will, it's the 7th page in your handout. Mr. Herring testified that in certain instances he might add additional staff, and he might also hire a security guard with additional counsel. At least that's what he implied. He never said, I don't have authority, I don't have power to hire a security guard. There's nothing in the agreement itself that says you have the power to hire a security guard or not. But what Mr. Herring's testimony goes to is his actual control and his exercise of it. And what he stated in that particular section is that I would not, and he's the manager out there, without additional counsel require you to hire a security guard, suggesting that he might hire a security guard. I might require staff to provide additional staff at a site at any given time. The agreement itself says you must maintain an adequate staff given the nature of the business and the needs to satisfy the customers, and there's a plank in the dealer agreement that suggests that. And Mr. Herring and I were bickering over what the word adequate meant. If this court believes that the adequate in that particular provision, and this is only one of the things the plaintiffs are relying on, but if the court believes that that language is not specific enough to, and that it is toward an end rather than specifically controlling the means and the manner in which the gas station is supposed to behave, then certainly Mr. Herring's testimony that, hey, I may require additional staff, is his actual control of the manner in which they may do that.
If
so Shell to some extent,
called,
we may be.
Shell calls you to represent them, and they said, here's our problem. Okay. We want to protect our people that are working out here, the customers, everybody that's on the premises, as much as we can. But we don't. We want to leave all of that responsibility to the dealer who is there on the premises. But we don't want to just turn a blind eye to it. If we see something bad, we want to try to fix it. But we want the primary responsibility to be the dealers, and we don't want any liability to these people for control. What would you counsel them to structure? How would you counsel them to structure the agreement differently than from the way this one is structured that would achieve those goals?
I would counsel them to structure it like the agreement that was used by this court in the Hirsch-Salonis versus Mendez case. In that case, it was a little bit different, and this court drew the line, even though there was, what it was a gentleman was on a job site, and he had one of these folding ladders, and there was a regulation in the agreement that says you can't, if you're a subcontractor, you can't use one of those folding ladders without unfolding it. You can't use it as a lean-to ladder. The guy gets up there and he decides not to use it as a lean-to ladder because he can't. Decides there's not room to unfold it. So he does something really stupid, puts a toolbox up there, stands on the toolbox, slips on some tools, and then sues. This court held there was no liability in that situation because the types of requirements that were in that case were so minimal that they didn't exercise control over exactly how things were doing. And there were basic reasonable security standards, such as obey all the laws of the United States and Texas regarding safety, obey the regulations, specific minimal regulations based on complying with local law and not exercising actual control over it. Because once you start exercising control over it, you're going in and saying, hey, we really want to do something extraordinary. We want to make sure our stations, and I'm just going to tell them that this is the price of doing business if you want your stations to be recognized for their safety. If you want your stations to be sought after by the public and they're going to pull into your station instead of Joe's across the street that's darkly lit, that doesn't have some of these other features, you're going to have to exercise some control. And you're going to have to exercise it in a reasonable manner, and you're going to be held accountable. And so to the extent that they can do some minimal things without incurring liability. And those would be the things that the court in the Hirsch-Salonis versus Mendez case instructed.
But the petitioner says if they're just trying to protect the brand, that shouldn't be enough, and you disagree with that.
I definitely disagree with that. The policy, Smith did mention to opposing counsel a question about that. He says, you know, does protecting the brand name include those kind of things? And he mentioned safety may be one of the things that you might use to protect your brand name. And I do believe that's the case. There's no doubt in my mind, and I think this court could take recognition of the fact that safety does sell in some instances. It has sold in automobiles now. Originally, people didn't think it would, but it does. And it does sell in convenience stores. People definitely like to be able to go into a well-lit convenience store that is safe at night and has the security guard present, and they'd rather choose to do that. So it does impact the brand name. It does impact the quality of services, and it impacts their business in a positive way. They make more money, and they get more customers. And the price they pay for that under any policy, we know that safety costs money. That's a standard basic presumption. Safety costs money. And it also brings in customers. And so the Exxon standard allows a oil company to make choices to protect its brand name but have the co-commitment responsibility of exercising its control
basic,
in a reasonable
but
manner.
But you are, in answer to Justice X's question, you're really saying that if you do consider safety to be part of your brand name, then you're going to be responsible for an event that happens at a franchised operation that involves safety.
Not necessarily.
Well, if you consider it part of your brand, you're going to put it in your agreement that you want the franchisor to do things that protects your brand.
That is correct. That is correct, but it's slightly more limited than that because the Exxon test still requires that the exercise of control be causally related to the incident. So in other words, you might not be, for example, if Shell only chose to exercise control over lighting, but this case involved training only and lighting wasn't, if this station in this particular case had been so well lit that it looked like the Super Bowl at night, and that lighting wasn't an issue, but the issue still was Mr. Khan's reaction to the robbery, which is an issue in this case as well, and Shell chose only to deal with lighting, but said to the station owner, training of safety is all yours. We're not going to get involved in that. Instead of what they did here, use our materials, train them this way, train them to do this, and if you don't do that, we can take this lease out from under you. That was an exercise of detail control. So even within the realm of general safety, the Exxon test requires a fact-specific causation, and that the alleged defect pled by the plaintiff must be something that they exercise control over. And I believe that's what's been satisfied in this case with the laundry list of defects that we have and Mr. Pankow's affidavit saying these things may have contributed to this incident.
Mr. Starry,
yes.
Can you give us a list of every provision in the lease agreement and in the dealer agreement that mentions the word safety?
Boy.
Do you have that?
I don't have that off the top of my head, but I can tell you that there are some. Opposing counsel mentioned to you that the agreement did say...
I'm familiar with some, but I don't know if I have all of them.
Yeah, and I apologize. It would be in the briefing if we had it, but Section 5.2 does say that they're responsible for a safe environment. But that, again, is kind of a result-oriented. I don't think that language in itself under Exxon would mean that everything that they do, they've controlled, that the Shells are controlled everything, because that goes to the end. You know, you got to be safe. That's the type of thing you can put in an agreement that would allow them to exercise, you know, some sort of impetus or push in that direction, but doesn't control the details.
Let me ask you a different question, sure, that you may be able to answer. Can you point us to the provisions in the lease and or the dealer agreement that say Shell is responsible for safety?
Well,
the petitioner's already pointed to lease agreement provision 6.1 where it says lessee is responsible for the safe and orderly operation of the business.
There is.
Is there something that says Shell is responsible?
I don't think so. But Shell does say you must do this, and it is a safety-oriented matter. You must do this, and it's a safety-oriented matter. And if you don't do it, we can exercise control over you and take this lease away from you. And that's what the exercise of control is. If you'll go to Exhibit... Exhibit number one, the dealer agreement itself does have some specific directives, and the most specific is in 11.1C, and it's one that's relied on heavily here. It says that the dealer shall have the responsibility. Now, that's an interesting word. Dealer shall have the responsibility. That language has been used by my opposing counsel in this case to suggest that the Smith versus Foodmaker case and the Barnes versus Wendy case have some sort of strict application here, and that language is some sort of magic language. It all depends on the context of the agreement. Just because you say this will be your responsibility doesn't mean it's your sole responsibility and we're not touching it. They say you shall be responsible for maintaining a safe work environment. That doesn't mean that Shell hasn't assumed some responsibility for how they're going to train their employees. In fact, Shell has assumed responsibility for how they're going to train their employees in 11.1C. When Shell says, dealer shall utilize training materials made available by Shell. Shell writes the training materials. That's an exercise of control. Shell tells, and if you look into the green book, if you look at exhibit number 4, the green book, which incidentally, Mr. Herring, interpreting the lease, in exhibit number 3, if you put number 3 up for just a second, he said that the green book wasn't an option. This is something that they have to do. It's required by Shell. So Shell is exercising control, saying you've got to use the green book to train. Go back to the exhibit itself. It tells them that your personal safety is first. Go to exhibit number 5, if you would.
So if the city of Houston required convenience store owners, gave a manual to convenience store owners that told them safety tips on robberies, would that be controlled?
Safety tips?
Well, I mean, those just strike me as very generic.
Well, they may be generic, you know, but they're not so generic as do exactly as the robber tells you and says, keep your contact with the robber brief. Don't ask him if you move your hands, if you can move your hands. Those are very detailed things.
What if this came from the local police association to all of the neighborhood?
Well,
be enough control to...
The local police doesn't have the ability to kick me out of my house if I don't use them and don't train my children. In this case, Shell says to the station owner, if you don't utilize these materials and you don't train your employees, we can yank the lease out from under. And that was the testimony of Mr. Herring in this case. That is control. And that is forcing those materials not just to be set on a table, but to actually be utilized in the training of the employers.
But you don't say there's anything wrong with the materials.
I think they're good materials.
Yes.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I think it's a responsible company that publishes those kind of materials. The problem in this case was, and Mr. Herring admitted this, is the audit department at Shell knew, and this is in the briefing, knew that Mr. Syed was a startup operator, knew that he wasn't very competent. He'd been tested and hadn't done that well in his training. There were memos going back and forth saying Mr. Syed is not, we've got to keep an eye on him. Had they kept an eye on him, they would have known, for example, that he didn't have workers' compensation insurance. That was also something that they didn't.
Doesn't it strike you as odd that if Shell were less responsible, if they were more irresponsible, and didn't provide these materials and didn't care a flip about safety, they wouldn't have any liability in this case?
Well, I don't think it's odd. It's the old adage that we learned in tort law that if there's a man overboard, you don't necessarily have to throw him a raft, throw him a lifesaver. But if you do, there ought to be a rope attached to it.
Yeah, so okay. It'd be better just to let him drown.
Well, it should. I mean, that may not necessarily be the greatest policy, but the fact is the law assumes that the person's acting and there's no affirmative duty to do those things. If you're going to maintain the corporate fiction, which is what Shell is doing here to avoid liability in cases. If you're going to maintain that corporate fiction, well, then the responsibility and the actions and the legal culpability ought to be on the person who's got that control, really.
But don't you think there ought to be some kind of safe harbor for corporations to generally require, as in Mendez, that you follow routine safety requirements? And some of these examples here, there are things that, you know, it's just a routine factor that might save the employee's life, and yet not subject the corporation to liability for doing that. And I'm just talking about general ones. They're not right in the store every day, you know, we don't have evidence of it here anyway, right, of them telling him exactly how to run the operation, when to lock the door, when to unlock it, what bulb to use. It's not that degree of control that we're looking at here, but just a general requirement that they conduct their operations safely. Shouldn't there be some kind of safe harbor there?
I'm not so sure there should be a big safe harbor, because it would turn tort law upside down and also reduce the effectiveness and the reason for the corporate fiction. The reason for the corporate fiction is to hold those people who are actually acting accountable and to absolve those people who are merely shareholders, merely have some sort of economic stake other than control. Well, once you start controlling and acting, and this is throughout all of jurisprudence, once you start controlling and acting, you've got duties to act responsibly. That's in board of directors cases, it's in alter ego cases, it's in every kind of case. So the safe harbor really isn't something, you know, hey, you can go in and exercise this control and just throw it out there and not do anything to enforce it, even though you have the ability to enforce it. I mean, if they wanted to say, oh, these are tips, you can use them if you like, that's one thing. But that's not what they did here. They said, you must bring your employees to these, and if you don't, we'll take your lease away. That was an exercise of control, very specific. Mr. Kahn was supposed to be, under that lease, he was supposed to be told to do exactly as a robber tells you to take a test, answer a question, saying, that's what I'm going to do. If a robber comes up to me, I'm going to do exactly as he says. He never got that test, even though that's what the lease required of him, was to get that test. Because he didn't get that test, he did just the exact opposite. He put his priorities in, hey, I'm going to protect Shell's money. I'm going to protect the station's money. I'm going to run to that door and lock it and do what I think is right for the company instead of me. Now, Shell, to avoid liability, and to avoid these kind of accidents, really not to avoid liability, but to avoid these kind of accidents and subsequent claims that may occur, they stated, you know, let's give him his training. He He never got that training. They could have required that training. They weren't mere safety tips. They were specific requirements.
Let me ask you a question before your time runs out. Now, the dealer sent this letter back when they were negotiating that said he would like this to be a modern, what they call C-store, I believe, and one of the points he made and why he wanted to do that was, I mean, generally he was going to bring in more money because more people were going to stop, but he also said something about women preferred well-lit stores. And as counsel brought out, that was prior to the execution of these lease agreements. Can you give me your thoughts on what the relevance is that the letter occurred before they were signed versus during the actual term of these agreements?
The timing isn't relevant because the fact is that there's no evidence that they didn't remain pending. In fact, Syed never received a response. So you
but did it merge into the documents? No, we're not going to build you a C-store. You're going to take this old mobile base station?
Don't know that. Don't know the answer to that question because I haven't read the language close enough to say whether it constitutes a merger or not. But what I can tell you is even if it doesn't, it's still an exercise of control. And it's still because they said no. Okay?
But it was before the relationship.
I got you. I understand your point.
Now, afterwards, if he said, during the term, he said, look, it's dark over there on that side. I want to put floodlights up. And they said no. I mean, of course, that's something different. But
I agree with that. They said no. But even assuming that the request was made beforehand and the relationship merged it, it's not actual control. It's saying no is an exercise of actual control. That's what it was. It was an exercise of actual control under the lease agreement, pursuant to whatever powers they had. But that's not the test under Exxon. The test is the right of control. The right of control, not the exercise. And even if you throw away...
But they're warning your rights before they sign the document.
Even if you throw away that request, even if you throw away that letter and that request, and assume it didn't occur, they still had to get prior permission to make the change.
Sure.
And the prior permission was still an exercise of control. And keep in mind also that we do know that it was darkly lit on the sides. Frank Cow affidavit says that that may have been a causal relationship, was that it was dark on the sides. The guy emerged from the side of the station in the darkness. If indeed it was dark and it was causal, Shell reserved the right under the agreement to go in and fix that at any time.
And they could have bulldozed that old store and built Fort Knox there.
That's true.
That's
exercising control.
Yeah.
That's exercising right of control, not necessarily control. So I would believe that would be the test.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. The Smith versus Foodmaker Court in 1996 got it right when it said that requiring written permission before improvements can be made is not the retention of control that's going to give rise for liability when someone is killed in a criminal act or shot in a criminal act at a business. And that's because virtually every landlord-tenant relationship is going to have some level of control by the landlord over the ability of the tenants to make improvements. You're renting a house, you're not allowed to expand the foundation and add a bedroom onto the house without the landlord's permission. In virtually no landlord-tenant situation are you going to have the situation where the tenant, such as Lasani Inc. was in this case, is going to have the unfettered ability to make improvements on the premises. And having the reasonable requirement that you get written permission before those improvements are made is not a specific retention over safety and security. With respect to the issue of the training manuals, I would point out that this court, not even before the Hirsch-Celanese versus Mendez case, and the courts of appeals analyzing this court's jurisprudence in the matter, have said that merely requiring a safety program by a general contractor for a subcontractor is not going to be a sufficient, in and of itself, exercise of control or right of control to give rise to liability. Shell's position is the same in this case. Requiring the training manual be incorporated into the dealer's training is no different than a general contractor having a particular safety program and requiring it be implemented. And there are no complaints about Shell's safety program. One more thing about the dates and the relationship between the parties. It's important to recognize that this store opened sometime in June 1997. The lease agreement and the dealer agreement are dated June 1997. This accident happened August 27, 1997. Mr. Kahn's summary judgment testimony is silent as to when he began working. But with respect to this theory that Shell somehow failed to discover there wasn't any training, there's no evidence to support that. because there's no evidence that as to how long Mr. Khan had been working, how Mr. Syed trained his employees, or anything like that. That's simply, those facts were not made part of the summary judgment response by the respondent in this case. It's certainly reasonable to conclude, to infer from the facts in this case, that Mr. Khan may have been working there for an insufficient time for Mr. Syed to train him. Nevertheless, the agreement, as shown to you by Respondent's Counsel, makes clear Mr. Syed has the responsibility to train the employees. Mr. Syed can incorporate whatever materials he wants, so long as the Green Book is included in that. Comparing this case to the general contractor-subcontractor context and requiring a dealer like Shell to have such a hands-off approach to its gas stations as general contractors have with their subcontractors, as suggested by Respondent's Counsel in answer to Justice Heck's question, ignores the fact that we have the issue of the dealer's interest in promoting its brand, an interest that Exxon versus Tidwell recognized, and virtually every court that has analyzed the wholesaler-dealer relationship has recognized. There is simply an additional interest that an oil company has that a general contractor doesn't have. And that's why this court, in Exxon versus Tidwell, made it clear that the retention of control has to be specific to safety and security. And with respect to Justice Wainwright's observations, I've not seen any provision in the dealer or lease agreement that addresses safety directly, that allocates it anywhere but the dealer. I've looked at both agreements at length, and I can't find anywhere where the issue specifically of security is addressed at all. And to say that Shell is liable for the plaintiff's injury in the robbery when the agreement makes clear that safety and order on the premises is the responsibility of the dealer would have the effect of making Exxon versus Tidwell meaningless. It would. I see that I'm out of time. I appreciate the court's attention.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments and the causes today, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise.